I'd like to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. My name's Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education here. And Tuesday Evenings is a weekly lecture program that I'm always really proud to present as free and open to the public. There are, in fact, a lot of things about Tuesday Evenings that make me proud. And next week, Dr. Mark Thistlethwaite, having given the first Tuesday evening lecture in 1979 on the work of Jackie Windsor, actually, is going to be here to present an acutely informed perspective, thanks to his longstanding and devoted relationship with this museum, on the art and programming of the Modern. I really do encourage you to return next week, assured that you will leave here knowing more than when you came on a number of subjects, and that your relationship with the Modern is certain to be enhanced as well. Tonight, we are pleased to welcome a new member of the DFW community, Dr. Beatrice Rodriguez-Balanta, as she presents her own expertise on the topics of colonialism and art in looking at the work of our current focus exhibition artist, Yinka Schonaber. Schonaber is a fascinating artist with a very impressive exhibition record and career, which includes being a decorated member of the most excellent order of the British Empire, hence the MBE following his name, also being a Turner Prize nominee in 2004, and a 10 installation that he produced that, in fact, launched him onto the international stage, having been invited to do that. I believe that, in fact, an image of that installation is in Beatrice's presentation tonight. Having described himself as post-colonial hybrid with work that explores colonialism and post-colonialism within a contemporary context, questioning the meaning of culture and national definition, Schonaber's interests are a perfect match with those of Dr. Balanta. Having received her PhD in Romance Studies from Duke University, where she focused on the visual and literary mechanisms used to refurbish racial and social hierarchies for her dissertation titled Realism, Race, and Citizenship, Four Moments in the Making of the Black Body, Colombia and Brazil, 1853 through 1907. Dr. Balanta's scholarship has earned her recognition and honors, including two foreign language and area studies fellowships in Portuguese, a Ford Foundation Summer Fellowship, and a Tinker Mellon Field Research Grant. With interest in research in comparative visual culture, the body, racial formation, Latin American and Brazilian literature, cultural studies, and nationalism, she has held teaching positions at the University del Rosario and Duke University, as well as her current position, which is what brings her to this area, as professor of art history at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, where she is teaching a class that I find intriguing, and if I can work it out, want to sit in on. Hopefully she will continue the class next semester, titled The Look of Freedom, all of which positions her to offer interesting insights into the work of Yinka Schonaber in tonight's presentation that she has titled Paradox, Excess, and Complicity, Yinka Schonaber and the Conceptualization of Post, with a question mark, colonial experience. So if you would, please join me in welcoming Dr. Beatrice Rodriguez-Balanta.
Ooh. Wow. I didn't think there would be so many people here. I think I'm going to tell the joke that I already told some people. I feel like this is my debutante ball. As I've never given a talk at a museum. But I also would like to thank everybody that made this possible, Andrea, Terry, and I imagine the acquisition staff who actually made it work so that Yinka's work will be here with us through the whole time that it's been here. And so I would like to start promptly because I have a couple of things to say. And I've divided my presentation into three parts. And even though people said not to read, I couldn't get out of that mode. So I'm going to read. But I would like somebody to be the designated person who says either you're reading too fast or we cannot understand, or something, by raising your hand and doing this, okay? I'm gonna take my things because they make too much noise, sorry. So I'm undressing instead of redressing. So, the title of my talk today is Paradox, Access, and Complicity, Yinka Shonibare and the Conceptualization of Post-Colonial Experience. In the foreword to the catalog for the exhibition titled Yinka Shonibare MBE, organized by the Sydney Museum of Contemporary Art, and which toured to the Brooklyn Museum and the Museum of African Art at the Smithsonian, Elizabeth McGregor writes that Shonibare's work raises searching and poignant questions about the complexity of European colonialism, race, class, and identity. Indeed, Shonibare's work, especially his use of Dutch wax fabric, has been interpreted as a practice that uncovers the substratum of modern and contemporary regimes of power, namely the violent commodification of the body and the work of colonized people, as well as the convoluted relationship between Europe, Africa, and Asia. In this presentation, I also turn to issues of colonialism and class identity. This paper, however, presents tentative suggestions about how we might engage Shonibare's iconic appropriations of the 18th and 19th century works of art as an aesthetic practice that seeks to redress and put into circulation the disavowed presence of colonialism in the symbolic and social practices of the European aristocracy during the rise of mercantile capitalism. As such, one of my interests is to discuss the political economy of visual culture in order to meditate on how capitalism, especially the emergence of consumer culture, can be understood in the secrecy of colonial relations. Okay, so technology. So, divided into three parts. Section one, paradox, art history and colonialism. Much of Shonibare's sculpture, and I should say that I'm only going to focus on Shonibare's sculpture, what people call mannequins. So here I won't be talking about his latest films or his photography. Okay? So section one, paradox, art history and colonialism. Much of Shonibare's sculpture transforms famous paintings into three-dimensional misrepresentations. In the process, he invalidates and intensifies the differences between the two media. One example is Thomas Gainsborough's Mr. and Mrs. Andrews and The Swing. Let us begin with Gainsborough's painting. The image shows a couple under an oak tree. He stands, gun on arm. It seems that he's ready to go or has just come from hunting. She sits on a wrought iron chair. Her uptight stance mirrors the tree directly behind her. This portrait was commissioned around 1750 to celebrate the marriage of Robert Andrews and Frances Carter. Andrews was a distinguished member of the landed gentry, although his family's power and influence was in part achieved through money lending and trade with the colonies. In Shonibare's cultural reworking, the couple is presented in vivid Dutch wax fabric. Their heads are missing, and so is the landscape. And we all know that Shonibare is always beheading his sculptures. Another one of Shonibare's appropriation is The Swing, a 1767 painting by Fragonard. In The Swing, after Fragonard, okay, so this is The Swing, right? So let's just leave it there. As in Mr. and Mrs. Andrews, without their heads, essential elements of the image have been rejected. Shonibare's version focuses on the central figure and expunges the lover, the man who pushes the swing, the statuses of Cupid and the two cherubim, as well as the lush garden. Shonibari's figure swings from a fake tree limb attached to a gallery ceiling. The gentle lady retains the ornate dress and highly recognizable pose of the original. However, instead of pastel silks and cascades of lace, she's clothed in lavish layers of Dutch wash fabric, which mimic the style of the Rococo. But Shonibari has altered the fabric to incorporate today's luxury signs, in this case, double C fashion logo of Chanel. And this is a detail that is not from that painting, but I couldn't get a better image of that Chanel logo. At this point, I would like to contextualize the political economy of the moment during which these paintings were created. In the 18th century, new artistic movements such as Rococo and genres such as landscape painting emerged. In general terms, the word Rococo describes the complex and fanciful decorative style introduced in France in the first half of the 18th century, which spread with varying degrees of influence across European metropolis and colonial spaces. Rococo began its ascendancy in the realm of architecture but became prominent in the decorative arts and visual culture. A variety of artifacts were produced using this style: drawings, engravings, trade cards, jewelry, chairs, bookcases, laces, tapestries, family portraits, and paintings such as the swing. According to Patricia Crown, the early 18th century defenders of the Rococo, or the modern style, as it was called then, argued that it was an ingenious art because it allowed practitioners freedom of invention and variation. Detractors in places like England and France complained that that the entertaining serpentine curves that characterized the movement did not follow any order, that it was lawless, that its complex compositions and irregular forms seduced the unschooled, that it was not for the gentleman of taste. By the end of the 18th century, the term Rococo was coined as a pejorative label by the crafters of the emerging field of art history. Its reputation has remained contentious, being seen as charming but frivolous, amusing but superficial, eclectic and formless. As maligned as the movement is, some critics argue that it began a series of radical aesthetic renunciations. It rejected the heroism and tragedy in subject matter, it refused hierarchical distinctions between media, and it refuted an understanding of art as the exclusive providence of the king, the church, and the nobility. In their place, Rococo artists and craftsmen highlighted a love for the clever, playful, and ephemeral in works of art. T.J. Mitchell has argued that the emergence of landscape painting illustrates a double movement. And let's just go back to the image, to this image, right, which is usually cataloged as a portrait, but also as a landscape painting. T.J. Mitchell has argued that the emergence of landscape painting illustrates a double movement. On the one hand, these paintings point to the violent expropriation of land which imperialism and nationalism demand. On the other hand, the renewed interest in the representation of the home landscape, the nature of the imperial center, illustrates the necessity of turning contested land into utopia, into utopic national space. In his commentary of the Gainsborough image, John Berger claims that this painting is a symptom of capitalist property relations. In Mr. and Mrs. Andrews, all traces of human labor are expunged. Instead of the peasants, notice that they're missing, what we see is evidence of the arrival of industrialization. The wheat field, so over there, okay, we observe in the foreground is not the result of the intensive work of human hands. Instead, it indicates the use of a new and controversial invention, Jethro Tull's seed drill. This is, in short, a thoroughly modern and efficient farm. Rococo and landscape emerged during a period when Europe had prodigiously increased the scale and diversity of its economic, financial, agricultural, industrial, and colonial activities. This was also the epoch when a new class began to inhabit power. The nouveau riche, as we will call them today, were the main consumers of this new style. since the style developed through the production of luxury goods, it was a genre that favor reacted to and depended on the market. As a generous employer of craftsmen, the Rococo was a lucrative business. Actually, maybe let's go back to... So this is the Rococo. So as a generous employer of craftsmen, the Rococo was a lucrative business. The use of new techniques and materials, such as stucco, papier-mâché, and gilt bronze, instead of marble and gold, meant that more artifacts could be produced for far less money. As such, the Rococo is one of the first art movements to be born out of the entrepreneurial desire to please and charm as many customers as possible. Moreover, it allowed the noble and the nouveau riche customers to forge a new language of luxury and taste. As we know, the 18th century was characterized by the accelerated enclosure or privatization of the English countryside. Enclosure is part of the modernizing process in which the land is colonized and private property becomes a new strategy of power. Gainsborough image, Gainsborough's image betrays signs of this process. The fences and the huddled sheep. So if you can see the fences right here and the huddled sheep over there. Okay. The fences and the huddled sheep are a visual reminder that this land has been titled to Mr. Andrews. And this is important because the idea of titling is beginning to emerge as the enclosure movement is arising, right? So this idea that you have a contract that actually makes you the owner of a land is emerging at this moment. The Andrews portrait reflects the gentry's desire to be portrayed at leisure and the equally potent desire to be immortalized amidst all of their possessions. Moreover, the absence of workers and the idyllic organization of natural space. I mean, if you see everything, it's like neatly placed. Right. Moreover, the absence of workers and the ideal organization of natural space elaborates the myth of the independent producer whose productivity depends solely on his own wit, labor, and capital, and not on the productivity of others. So this will be Mr. Andrews, right? So the question is, if Shonibari is aware of the significance of this image, why does he wipe out what could be considered the most significant sign of the emergence of capitalism? Right? There's no landscape. This is a paradoxical move, or at the very least, a very complicated one. One could argue that to remove the landscape is to erase a conspicuous sign of Mr. Andrews's power. However, the elimination of landscape could reference the erasure of workers from the scene composed by Gainsborough. I propose that Shonibari's removal of landscape is an effort to reorient our conversations about nation and empire. Conceptually, this piece wants to bring forth the viciousness at the heart of aristocratic leisure and luxury. Through this gesture, Shonibari reminds us that capitalism works on the body, that its most useful strategy is to provoke desire for objects and experiences. The elimination of landscape compels the observer to focus on the body. More specifically, our guests rest on the accoutrements that dignify those bodies: clothing, gun, dog. When we experience this installation, our pleasure derives from our enjoyment of their lavish attire and their posture, a stance that connotes ease and relaxation. We covet what they have. And to desire things is the proper currency of capitalism, the fuel of imperialism, and a strategy for identity formation. And actually, one of the things that interests me about this image is that he doesn't decapitate the dog. And as we all know, the dog is very important for Western art practices, right? The dog appears in Goya, appears in all kinds of people. But that's subject of another discussion because he decapitates the mannequins but not the animals. And so we will have to think about why that move, right? But I didn't have time to think about that. Shonibari replaces the silk in Mr. and Mrs. Andrews's dress for Dutch wax fabric and is an expensive printed cotton that has become a salient symbol of Africanness. Dutch wax fabric is a recognizable signature material in Shonibari's oeuvre, and then a complicated signifier for the history of colonialism. Of course, African fabric is not African. It is a commodity developed by the Dutch textile industry in Asia. In the 19th century, Blisco, one of the most important producers of this fabric, lost market share in Indonesia and was forced to develop markets elsewhere, including Africa, which became Blisco's major focus. According to the company's estimations, 75% of all fabric sold in Africa today uses Blisco's designs. It is rumored that the company does not hire African designers. Rather, it sends its employees who must have a keen interest in the exotic into the field to talk to wholesalers, distributors, and market dealers in order to create the hundreds of designs which characterize its textiles. Since the 1960s, African fabric has become an emblem of African identity. In the United States and in England, this commodity, along with African artifacts, has been used by the black middle class in their quest to create a cultural renaissance that sought to exchange a history of suffering and violence for a legacy of creativity, defiance, and respectability. Shoni Bari is well aware of the colonial history of Dutch wax fabric, and his extensive use of this material allows him to comment on the ways in which consumer products are used to foster the invention of identities and to advance capitalism. This is why the 18th century figures so prominently in his work. Moreover, wrapping the body of imaginary characters of Western culture allows him to bring to the surface the displaced and spectral presence of colonialism in the customs and customs of the British Empire. Historians designate the 18th century as a defining moment in the advance of consumerism in the West. In England, the consolidation of nationalist pride, it is argued, was achieved through the consumption of exotic commodities such as tea, silk, tobacco, sugar, chinaware, and cotton produced through a rapidly expanding overseas trade. This was the age, after all, when England prodigiously increased the scale and diversity of its economic and colonial activities. As mentioned before, the 18th century also saw the emergence of a new class. England's economic dynamism created new professions. Bankers, lawyers, merchants, notaries, interior decorators, printers, and painters were a few of the occupations through which social mobility could be achieved. Historians of consumerism have also discussed the dramatic shift in the dominant modes of status display and legitimation in early modern England. Elizabethan custom, for example, demanded a period of 5 generations before an upwardly mobile family could be fully accepted within the ranks of the nobility. By the early 18th century, however, rapidly changing economic conditions had permitted luxurious novelty to displace ancestry as the preeminent marker of social status. This is a story, in other words, of the erosion of a caste system in which status was assigned by birth and is replaced by a less rigid social structure in which individuals could assert social distinction through the display of luxury and investment in leisure. As we all know, luxury and leisure continue to be the motor of capitalist society. Mr. and Mrs. Andrews commissioned a painting to show off their individuality and power. The irony here is that through the circuitry of colonial commerce, both the Andrewses back in the 18th century and contemporary well-to-do Africans can manufacture an idealized image of themselves through the investment in cloth. Today, West Africans, where Dutch wax fabric is most popular, spend about $150 to buy 6 yards of fabric manufactured in Holland and England, and then when displayed on their bodies, announces their class standing and political positions. Because Dutch wax fabric was an expensive import in the 19th century, West African elites used it as a commodity that helped them verify, assert, and emphasize class, caste, and ethnic identity. Moreover, in the nationalist period, political elites subscribed to the equation of wearing clothing with modernity, as exemplified by various anti-nudity campaigns. Shoni Berry's consistent manipulation of cloth and clothing provides alternative views of the structures underpinning Western systems of commodification and reveals how adornment of the body's surface is a critical frontier in the production and authentication of identity. His practice also allows us to think about how power is represented, constituted, and articulated through dress. Finally, Shoni Berry's redressing reveals, not surprisingly, that privilege is built on the back of others, that luxury arises desire, and that the colonizer, in his quest for distinction, is colonized by the other. Let us not forget that the British consumer revolution of the 18th century was inspired by the variety and aesthetic qualities provided by Asian products, I mean, the craze for Chinaware, right? As such, they were imitating whom they sought to dominate. In this way, Shoni Berry critically engages the roots of consumer capitalism, attends to the cultural logic that underwrites the construction of identity, and challenges our own moment of globalized consumer practices. By resignifying classic works of art in the Western canon, Shoni Berry draws our attention to the political economy of visual culture and to the complex history of exploitation both in the metropolis and the colonies. Likewise, he emphasizes the multiple economic and cultural transactions that import the colonies into Europe and export Europe to the colonies. So that's the end of section one. Section two, access and spectacle. The human body is a central vehicle and tool for Shoni Berry's sculptural investigations. However, the body is an uncanny cipher since it is not a biological one, but its capitalist proxy, the mannequin. In this gesture, Shoni Berry imbues the changes wrought by capitalism onto the body of traditional figurative sculpture. If we want to look at the development of the mannequin, the trajectory moves from representing a specific individual, as in the case of funeral effigies, to the representation of the idealized human body, as in the case of the shop window mannequin. The mannequin is also related to art practice. During the Renaissance, they could be found in the among the easel and pigments in the artist's studio. Michelangelo, El Greco, among many others, used small figurines made out of red wax, known as lay figures, to sketch their compositions. However, as we consume it today, the mannequin's closest ancestors are the fashion doll and the wax effigies popularized by the Wax Museum. In the 19th century, the Wax Museum, one of the first institutions of popular entertainment, attempted to capture, represent, and reproduce reality by displaying effigies of distinguished members of society, politicians, criminals, as well as historical events. These effigies relied on a combination of iconicity, its powers of resemblance, and intexicality, its physical connection to a source, for its realistic effect. To achieve such realism, wax mannequins were often displayed with real hair, original items of clothing, glass eyes, and props, tables, books, guns, that supposedly belonged to the person portrayed. As such, these items served as authentic chains of reference. Wax museums also utilized the formal qualities of tableau or dioramas. In the museum, the spectator perambulated through exhibits of murderers in the act of committing the crimes that made them famous, fallen heroes, enactments of literary scenes, and reproductions of world wonders. Customers also paid to see freaks. Because wax museums often stage contemporary events, they offer a sort of history of the present, which emphasize the ephemeral, but also seem to extend the direction of the present. But because of his insistence on realism, the wax museum and the wax ensemble created a relationship of truth for the viewer and was mobilized to both instruct and dazzle the observer. In so many words, the wax museum taught people to become voyeurs. All the elements were there. The careful establishment of a supposedly invariable line between spectator and display, and oblivious figures absorbed in their own world, but that offered themselves to the eye of the witness in a hyper-realistic milieu. The rigoristic logic of the Wax Museum offered visual access to the scene of a murder without subjecting the spectator's body to any of its possible devastating effects. It was a position of mastery. It was a privileged new subject position, which was made possible by the simultaneous access to and protection from the context of the display. As Tony Bennett has argued, the institutions, history and national science museums, dioramas, panoramas, international exhibitions, and department stores, which embrace the exhibitionary complex, were particular because they transposed objects and bodies from the enclosed and private domains in which they had been previously displayed into progressively and more open public arenas. As such, the Wax Museum as a commercial institution organized vision for the edification of pleasure and pleasure of their visitors. Schoenberg has said that his job is to take people elsewhere, to create a wonderland or fantasy land for them. The enchantment aspect is absolutely central. He enchants by adopting the most important commercial strategy of the Wax Museum. That is the use of historical figures, real artifacts, and posing his figures in tableau. He arranges his mannequins, sculptures, in frozen stasis, but performing what they do best. Adam Smith in his library, Lavoisier taking calculations. Like the Wax Museum, he uses artifacts that help the viewer identify the helpless figure and at the same time help the mannequin become the persona it is supposed to play. In this manner, both the commercial venture and Schoenberg's practice rely on the topical and aesthetic fantasies of realism. Both bank on the compilation of detail to affect verisimilitude and wonder. Walter Benjamin identified shock, or in our terms, wonder, as the quintessential perceptual experience of capitalist modernity. As we have already stated, shock and wonder were the result of consumption through the eye. In a sense, the Wax Museum, together with other mass spectacles, allowed for the emergence of the gaze. As Coco Fusco reminds us, the gaze is an imperial invention. Since the early days of colonialism, the bodies of the colonized other were brought to Europe for aesthetic contemplation, scientific analysis, and entertainment. In the 18th and 19th century, the display of Aborigines served as proof of the natural superiority of European civilization, of its ability to exert control over and extract knowledge from the primitive world, and ultimately of the generic inferiority of the European races. Colonized bodies were consistently the object of shock and wonder at famous wax museums such as the Musée Grévin and Madame Toussaint, fairs and freak shows. One of the main contributions of postcolonial theory to the analysis of the process of colonialism has been its insistence on the role of spectacle in the configuration of modern racial discourses. As such, the gaze, the act of looking and enjoying the other's captured and naked body, has been pivotal in the construction of European sense of mastery. In the Wax Museum, the spectacle of the other and colonial discourse was refracted and fractured through popular entertainment. It was indirect, mediated, but it was also palpable and palatable. As art critic and curator Okwi Enweser has noted, the horizon of spectatorship is not just the space of encounters, but it is also a space of the gaze. He adds that all acts of subjugation and subjectivation are produced in the process of encounters between the clash of gazes and the incommensurability of the experience and knowledge that those gazes produce. The relationship between the gaze and its material effects is cogently captured in Schoenberg's installation entitled The Scramble for Africa. This installation dramatically reimagines the Berlin-Congo Conference of 1884-1885, organized by the German Chancellor Otto von Bismarck to formalize European colonial claims over African territories that had not come into the purview of European sight and dominance. Shonibari situates 14 headless mannequins around a table whose surface features an inlay map of Africa. They are dressed in formal attire, now fashioned out of batik. They dramatically gesticulate, negotiate, and fight over the share of the dark continent. A dark continent that, according to the conference participants, needed to be illuminated by their gaze and made available for the consumption through the techniques and technologies of modernity. Shonibari memorializes this event by bringing the spectator into close proximity to the site of the historical rupture that ushered colonial campaigns by countries that were new to the colonial enterprise, such as Belgium, Italy, and Russia. In this installation, history is repeated and put into circulation. As in the Wax Museum, the gallery visitor is invited to identify with and distance herself from what this conference produced, that is, the indescribable brutality of colonialism. This is a critical aesthetic moment. This strategy draws the museum goer materially and effectively into scenes of subjection. And as she watches the reenactment, she enjoys this act of murder. Thus, by recycling the techniques of the Wax Museum, Shonibari forces the viewer to participate in a colonial campaign that is usually disavowed, displaced, and negated. As a somatic aesthetic experience, this installation interrogates and reproduces the violence planned at the conference and forces us to enjoy it. He makes us complicit with and makes us aware of the benefits we reap from this act. At the end of the day, this is the fundamental triumph of colonialism, that we totally revel in its murderous enactments of power. Is this clock right? Okay. the prophets of the inauguration of a new stage of colonialism have been immense. It has touched our everyday life and changed the manner in which we conduct our most intimate affairs. The fact that we give diamonds to our beloved, that we have computers, and that the safari has become an increasingly affordable pastime is testament to the success of the Berlin Conference. This meeting of the heads of state has even benefited Western art. It is worth noting as well that the extraction of valuable resources that motivated and constituted the scramble for Africa also made possible the introduction of a variety of African arts, artifacts, and textiles into the great museums of Europe and fueled an aesthetic language, primitivism, that renovated modernist aesthetic in the West. Gauguin, Picasso, Matisse, Klee, among others, owe their fame to the Berlin Conference. And so do the museums and auctioneers that amass capital and audiences by exhibiting and selling their works. Sorry, so there's no transitions or anything in my presentation. Section 3, defacement. Shonibari, so this is the, I think I'm going to just make this my last section. Shonibari usually beheads all of his sculptures. I tend to believe that Shonibari does this to obliterate the currency in artistic and cultural practice of the portrait. I think Shonibari's beheadings critique the role of portraiture in the creation and maintenance of social hierarchies and in the formation and naturalization of social categories of identity, crucially that of the individual self. Just as consumption of luxury products allow non-hereditary elites to demonstrate their social standing, the portrait became a way to invest these new subjects with mortality and power. Identity conceived as unique personal individuality articulated in the face is a modern invention that surges forth in the 18th century. The idea that the face indicates individual identity while the body does not persists in contemporary Western culture in the disembodied faces of our picture IDs and the widespread consensus that blurring the face alone in photographic, filmic, and television images precludes individual identification. Shoni Bari consistently denies his sculptures a face, which is to say that he removes the indexical relationship that has been construed between the face, moral character, and race. Actually, I should say that it's kind of interesting that the mannequin sculptures are usually of different races, and sometimes they're black, sometimes they're brown, sometimes they're... So they're never, let's say, you can never really diagnose them as a particular race. And I think that that's also really something really important about his work. Again, no time for that. With the dismantling of a system based on hereditary rights, there emerged the need to judge a person's character. Physiognomy, the belief that that the face reveals personality, reemerged in the 18th century to supply this need. Etymologically speaking, the term physiognomy derives from the Greek for judgment, nomon, and nature, physis. Historically, physiognomy constitutes an activity which seeks to understand personality and identity by analyzing the body and especially the face. The belief that the face discloses identity is certainly not unique to the 18th century. The ancient concept of reading faces was revived periodically during epochs of social conflict in the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, the 19th century, and in our current times with the advancement of facial detection software. In the 18th century, physiognomy was refurbished with the language of empiricism, and the Swiss pastor John Caspar Lavater put it into circulation once again. What concerns us is that the science of physiognomy influences a wide variety of disciplines. These include the visual and performing arts. Painting, sculpture, photography, literature, drama were influenced by physiognomic discourse, particularly to the analysis of the expression of the passions. In aesthetics, in debates over notions of beauty. In theology and philosophy, the idea that the face allegedly reveals the nature of the soul. In anthropology, through facial analysis and classification of different human groups. In law and criminology, notably through efforts to define criminal facial traits, facial description featured in protocols developed for identifying vagrants, deviants, and criminals from the Renaissance onwards. Psychology and psychiatry, the analysis of an inner self through external signs. Physiognomy, then, is a technology to make decisions about others and relies on the unification of the physical and the metaphysical. Shoni Bari's defacement of his sculptures eradicates the claim to authority, individualism, and rationality. If the surrealists used the mannequin to meditate on the relationship between technology, modernity, and capitalism, Shoni Bari uses the same medium to reflect on the relationship between capitalism, power, and colonialism. The mannequin directs attention to the tensions between surface and depth, human and inhuman, biology and machinery. There are imitations of bodies, simulacra. They simulate life, but they are frozen, dead in time. But most importantly, the mannequin calls our attention to a form of power that subjugates with impunity. After all, mannequins are our doubles, but they exist solely to allow us, living beings, to consume. They exist for us, and we do with them what we want. Moreover, the mannequin refers to the circulation of commodities that could only have come into being through the establishment of colonialism and the violent instrumentalization of the African body in this process. I think Shoni Baris continued defacement of his fiberglass mannequins, which are supposed to stand in for both historical and imaginary beings, lead us to think about the emerging postcolonial, transnational, and global regimes of power, capital. And we know that capital migrates in and through the bodies and bodily practice of the socials. So power works through the body and at the same time decimates or transforms those bodies into lifeless relays for itself. The individual, as Cartesian philosophy has imagined, does not exist. The individual does not choose. The individual cannot be identified. But his or her body is constitutive to the realization of power. What we are left with are the inanimate bodies through which power speaks, reveals, and animates itself. Moreover, mannequins are pristine examples of the strategies by which commodity fetishism becomes naturalized and an element of everyday life. Mannequins embed their beholders in a visual economy of display in which the currency is desire for the commodity. The mannequin excites us to covet its existence. Shoni Baris' use of mannequins underscores the importance of clothing and attire in the construction of identity. He encourages us to examine how consumption of fashion, for example, among many other things, I think that leisure is also one of his main sort of preoccupations. So he encourages us to examine how consumption of fashion, for example, may lead us to reflect on the manner in which colonialism infiltrates the everyday and how much we depend on this particular form of jouissance. The mannequin will always be there because it cannot be reduced. It does not disintegrate like human flesh. It disintegrates into parts. So when they are made to represent spectral aspects of colonialism, their solidity, their immortality, and also their arrangeability can incite us to think about how colonial regimes are still in place, but perhaps with another face. Okay, I think I'm going to leave it there because I have another section, but it's like 8:45. Thank you. Oh. So, questions, comments?
I'll start. You've talked about the mannequin in the end, and all of a sudden it just occurred to me that, in fact, his really aren't mannequins. He's like animated the mannequin.
Mm-hmm.
What do you have any ideas or any thoughts on that? The fact that he's not, you know, when you that only occurred to me when you talked about being in parts, because I assume these aren't in parts; they're
mm-hmm.
one piece,
mm-hmm.
which I hadn't realized. But they're very animated; they're
yeah.
not the mannequin.
And the other thing is that actually, I don't know if you could see, for example, here they're very quote unquote realistic, right? You can see like the. Lines of hands and all that kind of stuff. And so I think that they're both animated in the sense that I want or I think that they want to do some historical work. So in a way they're working against the mannequin that we're used to, right? The mannequin that is just standing at the shop window just sort of inciting our desire. And so I think that there is an interesting sort of way in which he's working with the idea of the mannequin, because
right.
the mannequin is not new to contemporary or to modern art practice, right? The surrealists used them and all of these things.
Okay.
So I think that there is because he's so interested, or at least the way I read him, he's so interested in this sort of circulation of capital.
Mm-hmm.
So he's interested in how they work in the shop window, right? He's interested in how other artists have used them,
mm-hmm.
and he's also interested in them for them to do some work for him.
Right.
And in a way, it's sort of like they stand in for humans, but they're not, because at the end of the day, they might not be in pieces, but they're still sort of
right.
inanimate objects.
Yeah.
So I think that they're doing at least three kinds of work at the same time.
Very good.
So I think that that's a partial sort of answer. But I think that I'm still thinking about why is it that he used it. And the other thing is that they're not necessarily mannequins, because if you, let's say, if you look at them in let's say, Western art practices, when you put, let's say, a thing on a pedestal, well, this is not a pedestal,
right,
but on a, they're considered sculptures.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's like another sort of fourth way in which you could read these things. So maybe we shouldn't call them mannequins. And at some point I call them mannequins slash sculptures slash bodies. Right.
But I think you're right. They're referencing mannequins for sure. I mean, obviously, but it's, I hadn't realized until you said that, like how he's twisted that.
Ooh, okay. Is somebody moderating? Okay, so 1, 2, 3, 4.
How does he construct his mannequins?
Ooh, actually, ooh, wait a minute. I hear that that's a secret. The only thing I know is that there is some sort of place where he sends specifications to and they make them there. But I have no idea about if there is like a real model, as in the Wax Museum, which usually had a real model, or at the beginning of the sort of mannequin craze of the beginning of the 20th century, there would usually be a human model for the mannequin. I actually have no idea about that, but since there is somebody here that represents him, maybe you can say something about
how he does that. He uses real models.
Okay.
I mean, so he basically talks with a group of people that create these objects, because he physically does not produce them himself, and one of the mannequin maker is someone who he's been working with for 15 years, and they have very specific ideas and kind of language to define what character and what hand motion, etc.
Very good.
So yeah, it is quite specific.
Okay, you and then you.
So I'm wondering why doesn't he decapitate the animal?
Ooh. That is a question that I'm still so baffled by, right? Because I haven't seen any other animals in his work. Well, actually, yeah, there's the ocelots and the pugs. In, actually, did I show an image of that? So, actually, there is... there is other animals, and he never decapitates them, right? So, if we think about maybe this idea that I'm playing at the end, which is this idea of physiognomy and the portrait, right? These bodies, in a way, anybody can stand in for this body. If you put a face to them, right? Our history has taught us that then that becomes a portrait, right? That becomes a particular person in a particular moment in time, et cetera, et cetera. So the answer might be around that line of thinking. That if you have a face and a head, you have a particular person, right? So that could be an answer. The other answer could be that we have sort of enthroned the head in our sort of Western culture, right? The head, the brain, our personality, all of those kinds of things supposedly happen up here, right? And so in that sense, maybe he's trying to decapitate that idea that the head is the seat of our personality, right? That's as far as I've been able to sort of think about that. But I haven't actually thought about why the animals are not decapitated, right? Because that's an answer to why he decapitates the mannequins, but that's not an answer as to why he doesn't decapitate the animals. But with relationship to the dogs have such a long-standing sort of history in painting, right? That maybe we should talk about what have dogs meant for our history or for our practices in the 18th and 19th century, which he seems to be sort of really interested in, to try to figure out what that is.
Oddly enough, I've been thinking a lot about what dogs do in the 18th
and 19th
century.
Okay, so what are they doing?
I was wondering, one of the things that I was thinking about while you were talking is that, especially since we're looking at Lavoisier here, the decapitation is also about removing rationality, right?
Exactly.
About reducing people to bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And if animals are already bodily, you know, that there's not, that since they're not you know, notionally endowed with rational thought, that they don't need to be decapitated because they are already the body, and that there's maybe there's something going on here about dualism that might be playing in as well.
Exactly, and the thing is that in the 18th and 19th century, we also have these emergence of sort of interest for the animal body, right? Like, we actually begin to sort of think about them and study them and dissect them and do all those kinds of things. But I think that you're right. There is a decapitation of logos, right? Like, there is something that he's trying to do with this idea of rationality. But as that's as far as, the, as I've been able to sort of go with that idea.
You beautifully explained about the reasoning behind the decapitation. I loved when you said that it's obliteration of a portrait, and you opened up with Thomas Gainsborough's Mr. and Mrs. Andrews, and in that painting, they're stiff, they're very formal, and very proper, and yet in the decapitated Chaudhary's work, they take on a personality due to the vibrance and the richness of the fabrics, which all of these characters do without a head.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that he is also transformative in how a persona can still be obtained through the garments and the vibrance, because it says, it expresses emotion without having the face, and I find that just enthralling.
Mm-hmm. But I think that this is sort of my interest in this sort of decapitation thing, because I think that one of the things that is going on and that I keep on repeating was that power or whatever happens to us happens to the body, right? So we dress the whatever ways we dress, you know what I mean? I think that one of the other things that he's trying to do, even though when you go to the exhibits, you have to see, you know, because of the spaces, gathering spaces and museum spaces, what you do is to look at these sculptures. I think that the other thing that he's trying to engage is this question of the senses that are not just the eye, right? Because, I mean, like, African fabric also have this idea of depth, right? Like, there's all of these sort of, like, juxtapositions, colors and stuff like that. So it's not just this sort of distancing look of the objects out there, right? The way usually the gallery and museum organizes them, right? And so I think that they acquire personality partly because we see them there doing something, right? But we also cannot, but what I think is that if you don't know the painting, if you don't know the reference, you cannot really identify them, right? But you can sort of, in a way, enjoy or actually imagine what, or you can put yourself in the place of them, or something like that. There's something interesting that is happening in this sort of removal of face and focusing on body, right? But it's also interesting because most of the bodies are completely covered, right? It's not like there is, like, the only thing in most of the mannequins what we see is basically hands or arms. We never, they're all, because this is probably because he's, in the ones that I've chosen, he's so interested in the Victorian sort of era, where the body itself is not shown, right? So that's also an interesting sort of take on this sort of circulation of emotion through the body, but a body that is not shown in the ways in which we're so used to now seeing sort of everybody's spirit at all, right? So I think that that's also interesting about how he plays with sort of these things.
Can you go forward to the picture of the two faces, removing two faces at one time?
The removing two faces at one time, what do you mean?
It's after defacement.
Oh, what happened? Technology. How do you do this? okay, so the first one, you mean?
No, keep going forward. It's towards the end.
The blowing two heads
of
two.
The blowing of two heads. I think
that one. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's colonial pictures, it's colonial times. Why did you select ladies? You wouldn't have had ladies with pistols or engaging in duels at that time.
Okay, true, maybe. But they were enjoying all of the sort of benefits evidence of actually doing that, right? And so, for example, when you see the Gainsborough bees, it's he who's going out hunting,
right?
But there is some sort of like thinking about what she would have on her lap. And some people say that it might have been like the product of his hunting or something like that. So I think that while they were not shooting, let's say per se, they might have been doing things that were sort of in comparison to that. But it's not also to say that women couldn't enact pain, right? Because if you think about, okay, so let's say if these ladies were in the 18th and 19th century, and let's say that they were in a colony or something, they might be inflicting pain. I mean, in terms of like beating up their servants or doing something like that. So I think that by having them do something that we don't usually assimilate with their being ladies, he's actually bringing forth the fact that women can actually also inflict pain and have done it for history.
Well, I know they can inflict pain.
I mean, but he's also a conceptual artist, right? So this is the other thing, that he's interested in realism, right, which is the one thing that I really like about him, because I'm obsessed with realism, but he's also a conceptual artist, so he's, in a way, allowed to have these sort of flights of fancy, if you will, right? I think I lost count, but there was somebody over here, and then over there, sorry. Okay, so
I think it's really interesting that the word decapitation keeps being used because it speaks to a kind of violence that, except for this image, we don't usually associate in his work. And also the idea, through the history of art, I mean, going all the way back to early Egyptian times, and the decapitation, and for iconographic reasons, and so on and so forth. And it's such elegant, beautiful work, and then to counter with this notion of extreme violence, we don't, we sort of naturalize it. We don't think of it so much as a headless figure as a decapitated figure. And not to be glib, but I think that's one reason why decapitating the dog wouldn't work, because you don't see images of decapitated dogs in the history of art, and it would be a sensational, distracting sort of image, I think.
But it's kind of interesting, you know, because I started using this decapitation word when, I mean, like most of the sort of references they have to headless mannequins use his own words when he says that he was referencing the sort of guillotine of the 19th century, which I believe him, you know, that this is like one of the sources of this act. But I'm also sort of like, you're probably doing something else, because it's not like this happened in one series of his work. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not aware that he has ever had a mannequin that has a head. So I don't quite believe him when he just says that this is only referencing the sort of decapitation of the guillotine. So that's why I rather use headless or something like that, because I think that is beyond the sort of like imminent violence of that moment. I think that there is also something else that he's trying to do with that. And I think that because he's so interested in the history of art and in art history, I think that the first thing that he's doing is something with the portrait, right? The second thing that he's probably doing is something which I already talked about, is something with the sort of discourse that sort of made the head or the face the most important thing to identify someone. Because if you think before the 17th, 18th century, kings, queens, and all of that were sort of identified to being senior. You know what I mean? Like, the head itself, just the face, wasn't going to tell you a whole bunch of somebody, about somebody, right? It was the sort of the clothing and the marks of the body that would reveal, let's say, identity. And so I think that in that sense, I don't know. But I think that maybe he could do some violence to the animals, because we've had, dog fights. I mean, I just came back from North Carolina and I just like discovered some rain of murdered dogs, and they were all like left on the road. Right? So like we've also done violence to our animals. I mean, we eat cows. And we, you know what I mean? Like, we, our existence is based on the sort of violence that we do to animals. So I think that that's also something that is intriguing about that move, that he leaves them intact.
I'm just thinking that the clothes are kind of the answer to the decapitation. Yeah, we're looking at a generalized image of colonialism here, which the clothing certainly symbolizes. And it depersonalizes the effects of colonialization over a large group of people around a table. But they're still, you know, figures that are co-opted into colonialization and its effects.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't surprise me that if you have a dog that has absolutely nothing to do with colonialization, he's allowed to keep his head.
But
and, then the other, question would be, if you dress the dog up in a batik suit, would he decapitate it?
Well, but it's kind of interesting because dogs have everything to do with colonialism, right? I mean, like, hunting of slaves was done with dogs, right? Tracking the slave fugitive was done with dogs. Sort of the arrival of conquerors, they arrived with dogs also, right? Dogs are for war and all of these kinds of things. So the dog is also an interesting sort of and dogs for hunting, which is like what it appears there in the Gainsborough image. So I still sort of this sort of, I mean, and it's not to say that dogs appear all over his work. I mean that's not true. You know, and so I think that at the end of the day, what he's trying to do is to, in a way, sort of make us aware that we all reap the benefits yesterday, today, and tomorrow of the colonial secrecy of commodity exchange, as I want to think about it now, right? Dogs included, right? I mean, we're now eating, going back to the cows. We eat a lot of meat from Brazil, right, and from Argentina. And we've had colonial relations with them. And so in a way, I think that at the end of the day, the sort of big lesson to learn here is that colonialism is not dead. And that it's not even more, I think that the most important thing about his work is that he makes colonialism essentialist practice, right? We enjoy it. And we enjoy it whether we want it or not. I mean, like, the fact that we're all dressed right now, you know what I mean? The fact that the day that you proposed to your wife was such a memorable sort of moment is imbued with colonial relations, because the diamond didn't become sort of the thing that you do to engage with somebody until sort of after the scramble for Africa, right? So I think that what's interesting about his work is that postcolonial theory has been so invested, let's say, in the sort of violent, you know, the violence of colonialism, which I'm not saying that giving diamonds is not violent. What I'm saying is that he's actually showing us how, the sensuous kind of nature of colonialism and the things that we enjoy about it and how it allows us to sort of do the things that we do every day. Get dressed, drink water, eat meat, or other things.
I'm wondering about the place of critique in the work, because what you've been laying out in so many ways is this complex kind of indexical system of the way that power and capital is deployed through colonial relations. But you mentioned leisure and commodity, and say, you know, the indexical sign of Coco Chanel or the indexical sign of a sculpture. And I wonder how the sculpture itself, how the training of artworks is also, or maybe not, wrapped in to a possible critique of the way that leisure and capital are deployed.
How do I go about answering that? actually, I'm going to throw it back to you. What do you think? Because I think that the other thing that he's doing, right? I mean, like, if we just go back to the sort of the to that brief comment that I made about the scramble for Africa, right? One of the things that the scramble for Africa allows Western art is to revitalize itself through the sort of consumption of African artifacts and the sort of bringing forth of primitivism, right? And so in that sense, and also the other thing that he's such a current artist in the art market. And so we have to wonder why, I mean, he's great, don't get me wrong, but we have to wonder why he functions as such a currency for the art market, right? And I think that one of the things, so maybe I should confess that when I first saw his work, I was just like, never, this is beautiful, and it's full of colors, you know what I mean? This is beautiful, right? And I was just like, partly because I'm from Latin America, where conceptual art is sort of has other traditions and is sort of engaged in other kinds of practices and stuff like that. And the beautiful might not be is sort of currency. So when I first saw it, I was just like, this is just sort of beauty and whatever. This is why he's so famous, right? And so I think, no, I obviously think other things, right? But I think that we will have to wonder why if what I'm proposing is that he's doing such an interesting critique of capitalism, right, and of colonialism. Why is it that his works of art are such a currency for the art market, right? And I actually haven't been able to answer that question yet. I think that at the surface level, it's because they're just beautiful, right? Because it's full of color and blah, blah, blah. And I also think that because you actually have to sort of maybe know a lot about history in order to actually get what he's doing. But I think that's true with all kinds of conceptual work. So, I don't know. I mean, what do you think? Like, what do you think? I mean, like, and the other thing is that it's sculpture. What I think is also interesting is that sculpture, in the little that I know, I mean, because I'm no art historian, sculpture has been that kind of art practice that in the, let's say, 20th century has been transformed into now figurative kinds of sort of representations. And so I think that this return to a sort of figurative kind of sculptural work can also give us an answer as to why he's so sort of current in the art market. But I don't know. I mean, I still have this question about why is it that a work that seems to be so sort of engaged but yet understated and yet whatever seems to sort of circulate everywhere, and all of a sudden he's like everywhere. I mean, you know what I mean? And MPE and Turner Prize and making tons of money. You know what I mean? So I don't know.
I guess it's more of a comment. You could refute it. And so I guess what I'm thinking is that I'm thinking, one, that we might want to say that the photographs are also sculptures. And that means that the photographs also contain the mannequins. And that also means that the head is restored when Mika Shonabari appears in the work.
Exactly. That's why I didn't want to deal with that. Because they would just like, they would just destroy my argument. The sculptures, and the thing is that the photographs, I mean, I think that there is one here, right? That the photographs not only restore the face, but restore identity, restore portraiture, restore all the things that I'm saying that he wants to do with. And so I think that in that sense, we will have to ask if what I'm saying has some sort of grain of truth, right? Why would he choose to behead in the form of sculpture? And why did he choose to restore identity in the form of photography, when photography was one of the sort of technologies that actually allowed for the rise of identity and the rise of sort of all the things I'm saying he's critiquing, right? And so And the other thing is that he's moved to place himself in all of this. So no longer is he sort of representing this sort of like famous, sort of like some one time he has Kant and all of these sort of famous historical figures, but now he's sort of like putting himself in the role of these sort of historical figures, right? And so, yeah, so the short answer is, if I sort of include photography, then I'll have to start thinking about other things. But I think that question is interesting, right? Like, why does he choose photography as the medium through which he will restore identity and all of those things, precisely when that has been the technology to actually sort of bring to the forth all of those things, right? We're nothing without IDs, for example. Right?
Yeah.
And everybody puts their pictures in Facebook or whatever. Like, the photograph is the technology of identity.
Well, it's also one that can be photoshopped.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Can be restored. I mean, if you look at, for example, in this post-colonial critical way of examining the past, there's, I'm going to mispronounce the name, but for example, there's the last surviving member of the Beothuk tribe in Canada. She was, I think one of the names that they gave her was Nancy April or Nancy March, I think, and after the month they found her. And she made these incredibly beautiful aerial drawings of the land that she lived in for these colonists. And when she died, her head was sent to England and not her body. And then when the Germans bombed London, her head was gone. Mm-hmm. So when the head is gone, how can you restore it unless you have Photoshop? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that there's these ways that he has to go to that technology.
Yeah.
In the photos we have, at least in this exhibit, they're only of people who are dying.
Yeah.
Well, aren't they in this exhibit here? So that maybe he'll restore the head when they're dying.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
I think you've left us with a lot to think about, and we should leave it.
Thank you.